Good morning, everyone. I'm going to ask that Linda Miller, who's the former director of Human Rights Commission and has been a TMR member since 1992, has asked to introduce our guest speaker. So I'm going to call Linda up.
I'm Linda Hall. No, I did not elope last night. Good morning. Good morning. Yes. I am pleased to be introducing Jack Mano, a dear friend, amongst my many positions in the past, we both worked at ESF. He still does. Jack came to ESF from the Great Lakes Research Consortium, where he served as its executive director before he began his academic career at ESF, where he is now a full professor. You should know that Jack earned a bachelor's degree from SUNY Binghamton, a master's degree from Environmental Science and Forestry, Forest and Natural Resources Management Program, and lastly, a PhD from Syracuse University's Maxwell School in Citizenship and Public Affairs. Professor Mano's scholarship focuses on the social transformation needed to develop an economy based on insights from ecology and ecological economics. His research spanning more than two decades in areas of ecological economics, fossil fuels, sustainable development, and indigenous values. His books include Ending the Fossil Fuel Era and Privileged Goods, Commoditization and Its Implications for Environment and Society. Professor Mano's teaching emphasizes critical thinking, problem solving, systems thinking, believing that these skills are essential for solving challenging environmental problems. Students describe Professor Mano as a spirited teacher who engages, challenges, and inspires. They say that his classes are lively, innovative, and fun. In 2011, students selected him as Professor of the Year. Professor Mano worked with the Onondaga Nation on a variety of issues and continues to do so. He was instrumental in collaborating with the Council of Chiefs and neighbors of the Onondaga Nation on the Two Row Wampum campaign in 2013. He has also often said that indigenous values and traditional knowledge would be best respected and promoted as a major component of this transformation. Jack has a unique ability to listen to people to the earth in ways that help him understand and lead us in a more caring direction. Please join me in welcoming Jack Mano, Professor Jack Mano, to Thursday Morning Roundtable.
Well, I'm going to start with what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about the effects of climate change and what that means for our environment, which is the title that was given for this talk. Well, you know. I'm not going to talk about climate science because I have nothing new to add. I'm not going to talk about climate science denial among scientists who work on the mechanisms that affect climate and whether there is 97% agreement that climate change is real and predominantly caused by human activities. I think the debate is over, although there's a lot of people who disagree. Why has the study of the atmosphere become so politicized? That is because effectively reducing greenhouse gas emissions will require changing our ways of life. Not easy to do. Dealing honestly with oppression, racism, classism, sexism, disability oppression, ageism, and intervening in markets to actively promote those human goods that are difficult to commoditize. And if you're interested in that, I have a book called Privileged Goods that I will plug. I'm trying to train myself to promote myself. I've been at ESF for 30 years, and I'm starting anew here. And on that line, I do have copies of my new book called Ending the Fossil Fuel Era that I will sign and you can buy at the end of this. They told me I could do that. What I will talk about, the issues of global warming have nothing to do with climate change per se. It's about people. And the only thing wrong with the planet is human confusion, carelessness, and greed. Climate issues are political, social, personal, and potentially transformative. And I'll mostly talk about my experience at SUNY ESF over the past 30 years that I've been there. And I want to talk a little bit about my friend and colleague, Karin Lindberg, because her story sometimes strikes me as at the heart of it's at the heart of the broken hearts at ESF. I don't know how many people know about, you know, scientists like Karin Lindberg. You know, she studies fisheries throughout the world. Like so many people at ESF, she loves her work. And when she was a student, getting her doctoral degree in fisheries science, she wrote a letter to the president, and the president at the time, I believe, was Jimmy Carter. So it was a while ago. But she wrote him a letter. And in the letter, she said, you know, she's being trained to be a scientist. And there's a lot of work she wants to do. But what she doesn't want to do is to be a chronicler of collapse. And, you know, she does an amazing amount of good work studying fisheries in the Hudson River and in the shores around Iceland and South America. And by and large, with some exceptions, that has been her job. She's chronicled the collapse. And that work of studying something that you love and getting to know it as well as any human being can possibly get to know. You know, it's interesting. Fishery scientists end up just loving fish. It's an odd thing, but that's, you know, that's what they do. And you know, people who work on rare and endangered species, you know, fall in love with them. And people who work on grasslands fall in love with them. And you know, so the even though we are scientists, and even though we maintain our cool and our in that we're not biased, but we have hearts and they're broken, and that's what I see at ESF after 30 years. Some very recent headlines: the Great Barrier Reef coral bleaching is worst in its history. These are all just in the last couple of weeks, April 1st. Climate change is messing with the Earth's axis as ice melts and adds to the oceans. The oceans get actually heavier, and now it's noticeable. You can measure that climate change is messing with the Earth's axis, April 11th. Climate change could spell bad news for your maple syrup, March 28th. It's interesting, we were mentioning that, you know, I've worked a lot with the people at the Onondaga Nation, and one of their prophecies has been, you know, when the maple trees begin to die from the top, then know you're in trouble. And there's some of that happening, and it's related to the future of maple syrup. 13 million in the United States could become climate refugees. Top counties affected, March 14th. Arctic sea ice is at near record lows, NASA says, March 26th. So the things that I've been working on a lot has been since my first visit to the United Nations, actually my first visit to the United Nations. I'll tell this story because it gives a little background on me. But I don't want to talk too long because I want to be able to have a conversation. But I'll go back to when I was 17 years old. And I was the president of the Model United Nations in my school. And one thing happened where the British ambassador to the United Nations, his name was Lord Carrington. He actually ended up years later being head of NATO, had invited me and a friend to come to the United Nations and spend a day with him, seeing what an ambassador did to learn, you know. Maybe that's what I would be someday. And as it happened, the day that we went, 1968, it was the morning after Russian tanks had moved into Prague, Czechoslovakia, and there was a threat in the air of a new world war. Everybody was scared. We got there and we said we had an appointment with Lord Carrington, and the woman at the desk called the British ambassador, embassy, and said, you know, these two boys say they have an appointment with Lord Carrington. Could you send somebody British down for them? and on the phone, the other end of the phone, they said, Lord Carrington is waiting for them at the delegates' dining room. So that was a thrill. We got to sit in. He was, as you might expect, he looked scared and sad and very contemplative. But in this, he did the sort of classical thing, right? That, well, a month from now, we're going to land human beings on the moon. Who would have thought? We have this incredible technology. We can do anything. And yet, we can't figure out how to live together. And that's up to you. Okay, all right, you know, I was 17 years old. I'm going to take that on. But, you know, in a way, that's exactly the same thing as we're dealing with now. You know, I went to Paris in November. This place, Basse Génération Climat, was the site for where all the people, there were these two big buildings that they put up, and they were all recyclable. They were all going to be taken down after all this big conference. And the representatives from nations from around the world met in one of the buildings. And then in the other building, they put all the people who had come to try to influence what was happening there. And there were thousands and thousands of people who came to try to influence the results of those negotiations. And I went with a group of people, and it was called the Sustaining All Life Project. And what we did was created opportunities. So what happened when all these people came, and they wanted to be heard, but they were in a whole different space from where all the people were negotiating. So we created lots of opportunities for people to listen to each other. This is one man we met that, you know, he had walked for 30 days from deep into the Amazon and eventually got a flight to Paris and was there to be heard. And so we created spaces like this. This is actually somebody else from Brazil, not the man that I was referring to. And we just created these spaces for people to tell their stories. And again, they were heartbreaking and they were inspirational and certainly reminded us again that the issue of carbon dioxide in the environment, in the atmosphere, which the science of that has been known since the late 1800s. There's no question about how it works. But that it's not just about the science. These are people, particularly poor people who are dependent on local ecosystems, are threatened with their lives. And so it is about people. And it's not just about climate science, which, of course, is really important. So the first time I went to work on climate issues was in 1992. And I went to Brazil for Probably many of you remember the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. It was also known as the Earth Summit. It was a big deal. Here in Syracuse, there were headlines every day in the front page of the paper about what was happening in Rio. And I was there at the time because I was working with people from all over Canada and the U.S., but focused on protecting and restoring the Great Lakes of North America. And one of the things that I had been studying around that was the sort of shift that was also happening at the United Nations for non-governmental organizations, as they were called, having direct influence in these world international discussions. And there were examples of something called the Great Lakes United that was both in Canada and the U.S., and when the U.S. and Canadian governments were negotiating the renewal of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, they had representatives from Great Lakes United on the Canadian side of the negotiations and at the U.S. side of the negotiations. It was a very interesting and new phenomenon. And there was a lot of that happening in the United Nations and the role of non-governmental organizations there. So I was there for that, but I also went to a gathering that were just people from the United States who were working on climate change. And Al Gore was there, and a lot of people who were sort of initially creating what eventually became the Kyoto Treaty. And again, there was a sense, it was a fairly large room, and people were just going around talking about what they were doing and what was on the agenda and strategies for getting the U.S. To back a strong agreement to reduce greenhouse gases. Now, this was almost 25 years ago. It's stunning to me that it was 25 years ago because we knew exactly what needed to be done. Not just me and the people in that room, but everybody actually who was paying attention to it knew what needed to be done. And at the same time, it seemed like there was no chance in hell it was going to get done. So my big question, of course, at the time was, well, why? What's in the way? Well, so of course, I'm an academic, so I wrote a book. And it was called Privileged Goods, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The other thing about what happened in Brazil was something called Agenda 21. Agenda 21 was a document. It had been circulating around the world for about 2 years prior to the gathering in Brazil. And it was a consensus document from expertise from every part of the planet. And it was an agreement about what needed to happen. And there were 34 chapters covering everything from healthcare to transportation to housing to water to everything that needed to be addressed in order for human development to become sustainable. Now, sustainable development was a big word at the time, and then when I got back, I taught the first course with our president, Ross Whaley. We put together the first course, I think it was the first course in the U.S., on sustainable development. And all that means is we have to figure out how to live well while living lightly on the earth. It's a relatively simple definition, and it can be done. There's all kinds of examples of how it can be done. And it's interesting how, if you look at, first of all, how money affects well-being, okay? Pretty simple thing. So, as people have more resource, have the ability to buy things, and they're poor. And the more they get, the better their lives get, the better off they are. That's, again, obvious. The most important thing that makes the biggest difference, and just in terms of goods, is the refrigerator. When poor people in the world have a refrigerator, their food security is so much greater. Their workload is so much easier. They're not having to get food from someplace every day or every couple days. They have a refrigerator. Life gets a lot better. So as people have money, as they develop, their lives get better and better. The more energy that they have to use, their lives get better. Up to a point. And that point is, and this has been calculated, it's roughly around $11,000 a year per person. After that, life still gets better with more money, other various measures of well-being, it gets better, but much slower. And then up to a point, it begins to slip off. So actually, the more money you get, life gets a little worse off. I'm not exactly sure why, but you know, those are the measures. As it turns out, that number is almost exactly, it's a little bit below, so we still have some room. But if all of the wealth in the world was equitably distributed, everybody would have the ability to live a good life and not continue to expand energy and material consumption. One of the things that I didn't put up on the screen about the latest headlines is one that the scientists calculated that in 25 years, not too far off, the total weight, just the weight of all the plastic in the oceans will be greater than the total weight of all the fish life in all the oceans. Right? Now, everybody knows. Everybody who thinks, anyways, should know that when you throw plastic away, eventually, even if it takes 50 years, eventually it ends up in the ocean. It has to. It can also end up in the Great Lakes, which is also a major problem. But how is it that we continually ignore the obvious as to what's going to happen to our future generations if we keep going in the direction we're heading? So the biggest challenge is to come together, both in communities like ours, but throughout the world, needs to happen. And that's what Paris was about. The obvious problem here is, here's the history from 1990 up to the Paris Agreement. And that's the gigatons per year of carbon dioxide emissions. And the UN's estimate, if all of Paris pledges worked perfectly, we're still going to increase the amount of gigatons in the atmosphere. But at some point, there's this impossibly steep crash abatement program. In order for us to achieve the goal that was set in Paris, and the goal was to keep the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere below the point that would cause an increase globally of 2 degrees centigrade. Right now we're at about 1.5 degrees centigrade, between 1 and 1.5 degrees centigrade. And that is basically to avoid catastrophe. If we can do that, it doesn't mean that we can avoid, because at this point, in 1992, when I was in Rio, and we started to develop the plans for the Greenhouse Gas Treaty, ended up being called the Kyoto Treaty, which the U.S. never adopted, was never a signatory to, it was possible to avoid crisis. Now it's not possible to avoid crisis. We're in the crisis. but it's still possible to avoid catastrophe. And so, you know, what that means is that these are incredibly important and rich times because you actually have the chance, the opportunity, and the need to come together and solve a problem. And that's actually something that human beings do really well when they decide to come together and pay attention and actually notice what's happening and notice what needs to be done. It's something that we can do. But we are very close to it being impossible, which is basically about 2030 something. All right, so that's what? Another 14, 15 years? That's nothing, as you all know. So we have a lot of work to do, but it's exciting. It's exciting work. And one of the things we have to do is to, Linda mentioned this, you know, is to listen to our neighbors, to our elders, the people who have been here long before our ancestors got here. One thing that has to happen is we have to learn to pay attention to the fact that we are, whether we notice it or not, deeply, deeply connected to the ecosystems around us. It's our breath, it's our food, it's our possibility for reproduction, it's life, right? We are dependent, and that is the one thing that Native people all over the world have been trying to tell us. I don't know, you know, I wish I knew. No, I think I have some insights and can talk about it, but I don't know why our people lost that awareness. But we're lucky that there are many people all around the world who have not lost that awareness, even though they may have not have been able to make things different. But they've been warning us. The people from Haudenosaunee leaders put out a book now in 1972. This is pretty remarkable. And it's called The Basic Call to Consciousness. If you read that book, and I suggest that you do, you'll see back in 1972, they were talking about that global warming was coming and this is what it was going to look like. But it was mostly about taking our responsibility seriously to the earth, to the air, to the waters. So back in 2013, now it's back already. Seems like a long time ago. Annie Major, Cindy Squalacci, both here, were also very active in helping to organize with the leadership at the Onondaga Nation and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And we organized a trip to just to try to get these kind of messages out to people. And boy, there was a great hunger to hear it. And it was the 400th anniversary of the first treaty agreement between the incoming Europeans and the native peoples in this area, the Haudenosaunee people, between the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee in 1613. So in 2013, we decided to use this as an educational opportunity, that it was the 400th anniversary. And we organized a journey called the Two Row Wampum Renewal Campaign. And it was Native people in their canoes and kayaks and non-Native allies in their canoes and kayaks going down the Hudson River. It's a little bit longer, but I'm not going to go into all the details. And travel down the Hudson River to the United Nations, where we were greeted by the Secretary General and all that kind of good stuff. And you know, I first got involved with the people at Onondaga, actually in Rio. It's interesting, but Orrin Lyons, who I'm sure many of you know, probably all of you know, he was the head of the delegation of Native folks who were at Rio, again trying to raise the awareness of the world leaders who were there making these agreements. And he really impressed me, because what was happening was, you know, there was such an incredible sense of possibility there, And yet when 109, no, there were 173, it was the largest gathering of heads of state in the history of the world. So presidents, prime ministers, kings and queens, and each one got up and spoke about environment and development. And everyone had a piece of paper that I could tell that they were reading but didn't really know it. Anyways, some of what I've done are in these books, and I do have copies of Ending the Fossil Fuel Era, which is a summary of some of this as well. It's a co-edited book, so it's with a number of colleagues. So the good news, what we can do, no one has the answer for how to solve the climate crisis, so do what gives you satisfaction and joy, right? But do it. Do it. Because everything, you know, there are so many things that need to be done, and then people sit around and say, well, what should I do? Well, there's all kinds of things. Take care of the environment around you. Pay attention to what really matters. Learn from people different than you. Vote and encourage others to vote. Give thanks every day and learn from our Onondaga neighbors who, you know, that's their primary message is of gratitude. Every event begins with the Thanksgiving address, giving thanks to each of these elements of creation that makes it possible for us to be alive. And what a good way to start a meeting. This is just a blessing that I want to leave with you. And it just says, it's called Earth Blessing. You can actually get this from the Syracuse Cultural Workers. May Earth Song reach us in our deepest and wildest places. May it be heard as we move upon her, as we partake of her sustenance, as we nestle in her waters and grasses. May we hear the voices of the stones, the winds and waters, creatures and plants, above the human chatter, softly but not silently, so we can heed them when we must. May all those who try to conquer Earth's powers learn instead from compost and humus and take from them humility, knowing any force conquered is lost forever to the conqueror. May compassion rack the polluter's heart, so stunned by Earth's gifts, their poisons cannot be released. At long last, may Earth's protectors throw grand parties where victory is declared in a mighty sigh of relief. May this exhalation resound in ocean depths, reverberate in humpback flesh, and please all the watery souls. May whales and wolves rejoice with weird shouts that all is well. May we have a world celebration where everyone stays put, our roots seeking amusements together deep in the earth, our branches entwined in the winds. May our grandchildren's grandchildren share legends of when we brought about the end of the time of arrogance and waste. May they toss stones from shores, hearing our names echo in the ripples. So may it be. Questions, comments?
It struck me in your talk the number of times you mentioned sort of questioning why do we continue to do things that we already know have bad results. I'll give you two examples. One, we heard this week that a number of the coal industry companies are going bankrupt, and so why did it take this long? The other example is while the Native Americans are certainly honorable in their way of treating the environment, we also know that both the Oneidas and Onondagas promote the sale of cheap cigarettes that we know kill people. So it strikes me money is at the heart of this not doing the right thing. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I would have a long comment about cigarettes and the and that industry, but that would take too much time. And other than that, you're right. You know, money, yeah, money, yes. The thing that is that people miss, I think, when we talk about money being the root, right, is they have to think about money in terms of every dollar or whatever currency you're using is an agreement. It's a legal right to a certain amount of energy and material resources. And you can actually measure that in terms of, you know, each dollar is worth, and it depends on how the currency is fluctuating and how the price of oil is fluctuating. But each dollar is worth roughly about 2/3 of a cup of oil. So every time you spend money, no matter what it is, ultimately, there is resources that are taken from the earth, transformed, and then ends up with waste. So the only real solution, which of course also involves concerns about numbers of people, population, but the only solution is that we have to figure out how to live well while living lightly on the earth, meaning living with less energy and material resources. And that means, getting to know each other, having good, solid communities, doing all kinds of interesting things that make life better that don't cost much money. Because it's not just money. That's the thing. Every dollar spent equals a certain amount of energy and material resources, period. So, yes, it is money, but it's more than money. Yeah.
Could you just give us ideas for what a family can do here in Syracuse, Onondaga County, that can make a big difference? Make a difference, never mind the big difference.
Oh, I think, everybody knows them. It's important, to pay attention to what you purchase, where it comes from and where it goes. Recycle as best you can. Don't waste things. Turn down the thermostat. Do that. Everybody has. The most important thing is build community, which is something that TMR has done forever.
51 years.
51 years. The basics are really clear. We know how to do it. It's just that we get discouraged. And it seems like it's too big and we're too small. But if everybody is, it's going to happen, right? The change is going to happen. The issue is, can it be done joyfully or will it be a whole lot of suffering? So, do what is going to lead to joyfully and away from the suffering. It's really that simple. And every person and every community and every household has lots of opportunities to think about it, about how they can reduce their footprint on the earth. And, doing that will make a difference. But it'll make more difference if it's not done just as, individual actions, but, more and more people doing things like, whatever you can figure out, like our two-row wampum trip down the Hudson River. I think we made a big difference. And you don't know. The thing is, one of the other teachings from my friends at Onondagas always share with me, the sort of seventh generation notion. But what that basically means is that I have no idea what the effect of my work is, because it won't actually manifest for another 70 to 100 years. So I don't worry about that too much. Do what's right.
Jack, it's wonderful to have you here. And
thank you.
It's inspiring to hear your joyful message of doom and gloom. But you do have great passion, and I appreciate that. How do you accommodate, or how do you make sense of the culture that seems to have changed quite a bit since 1992, and the fact that green is just kind of cool now? And there are a lot of steps that people in Syracuse and everywhere else are taking, and it seems to me worth acknowledging that there has been a shift.
Oh, absolutely.
And is it's just like all we hear. I mean, what we hear is it's never, never enough. Mm-hmm. And what's really coming has got to be really jarring. But is there some way to kind of congratulate ourselves, or at least encourage ourselves by the fact, or at least not succumb to complete despair, because the message seems to be getting through?
Well, you know, I think you're accurately expressing something very real. It makes me feel a little bit like I didn't do my job, because I definitely did not want to leave with that impression. And in fact, what I do think, and I think is true actually, is that, you know, first of all, there has never been a time on Earth when we weren't threatened by big crises. You know, whether it was illnesses, whether it was war, whether it was, you know, we've all had great challenges. And as we look back in history, we have great moments of rising to the challenge. And generally, the people who did that and survived it are the people who, in their old age, have lots of things to look back at and say, okay, you know, I did it. I did my best. So, you know, to me, this time in our lives is a time that is open to so much possibility, because the needs are so great. And also recognizing that it is true that whatever you do alone is not going to make much of a difference. But it will make a difference because you do it. And that kind of spreads. And just the fact that you are correct. One of the problems we have to get a handle on our economic system. And that is the biggest challenge. And it's a political challenge. But what happens, what we've done well, is be more efficient. The problem with efficiency is absolutely necessary for sustainable development. It's a key piece of becoming sustainable, is to get more and more efficient. However, when you become more efficient, prices decrease and people spend more and do more. So gas prices go down, you know, people drive more. So there has to be more than just efficiency. And the problem with the only part of this challenge that doesn't challenge our current economic system is efficiency. So that's what's plugged. So that's what we're encouraged to do. And that's what all the, you know, the small steps that you're talking about, and they're important. It's absolutely necessary. But efficiency is a necessary but not sufficient approach to sustainability.
I think that one of the basic problems is a lack of political will. There's a significant difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on climate change issues.
Yep.
And just not to blame other people, but myself and all the other people in this room, we're all world travelers. And one of the most inefficient things we can do is flying from point A to point B.
Uh-huh. Yep. But, you know, if in that point A and point B, either your mind expands or you make some connection somewhere, it may be worth it. But that's, you know, it's, again, every one of us has to make these choices at a, you know, you have to have your own gauge as to what makes sense. But just talking about, you know, efficiency and reducing your footprint isn't enough, because of what you just said. You know, it actually may mean if more people traveled to other parts of the world, that maybe our political system would be less closed and tight around these issues. I don't know the answer to that question, but.
I've just finished reading Paul Rogat Loeb's book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, which is
a good title. I don't know the book, but
yeah, it's based on a Billie Holiday lyric, which was also adopted in World War II by the Army Corps of Engineers. The difficult I'll do right now, the impossible will take a little while. Mm-hmm. And the main idea is that things that have often seemed impossible individuals or small groups have been able to change, sometimes very quickly,
That's right.
often over time, and you don't necessarily know, as you mentioned, the results of individual actions you take. One woman had what I thought was a wonderful quote. She said, "The problem is not that we have so little power. The problem is that we don't use the power we have." You know, I'd rather be on the team of hope versus cynicism, of trying to do something rather than just complain about the way things are. You know, that was another choice in the book. So it seems to me, you know, for those of us who are feeling that we don't have much power, I thought your message was very important. You know, do what you can. You know, you can do individual things. Conservation, I think, is important. Educating other people is important. But piggybacking off of what Ed said, I think the political piece is also very important. So one thing people can do is to email or call or send a web form to John Katko and others. I mean, he's not on the far right.
No,
he's considering supporting the Gibson Resolution, which is a Republican initiative acknowledging climate change. But his office says that he gets more mail against supporting it. So that's, you know, I think political activism is important in this context.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to know what your response to that.
Just that you're correct. That's my response. Yes, I mean, that's the big work. None of this stuff can happen unless it can happen collectively, and that's our political system. Our political system has become so difficult to change because of the kind of inertia that's been built into it, and you know, because of all the reasons, right? Big money in politics, and et cetera, et cetera. But see, that can change and is changing. And, you know, I just think that you're exactly correct. I know that Andy's had his hand up a long time, and he's probably got a question.
For a while now, I've been getting emails from Amazon when I purchase something asking me to evaluate their packaging. I get a lot of emails from vendors asking me to rate their services, but Amazon is the only one that I'm aware of that actually focuses on packaging. Mm. And I was thinking that locally, if you look at Aldi's, that's the only place I know that charges you if you're going to use a plastic bag. Some of the local companies...
Price Right does, too.
Oh, what does?
Price Right.
Right. Oh, Price Right does? Okay, I don't...
Down there, yeah.
Okay. But some of the other grocery stores had some incentives to dissuade people from using plastic, but it was very short-lived. What can we do to encourage manufacturers and retailers to pay attention to packaging, and in particular, the excessive amount of packaging?
Plastic bags need to be illegal.
It's terrible.
This is one of the remarkable experiences I had. It was actually in Ireland, and I was there at a meeting. Actually, Jim Walsh brought me. That was interesting. But and I was there the day that the new law requiring every store to charge 5 cents for a plastic bag. Within 2 days, plastic bags disappeared. Nobody wanted to pay 5 cents. They would bring their old plastic bag back and reuse it, or they would do, right? You know, it doesn't take very much. 5 cents? Yeah, maybe it would take a quarter now. This was, you know, 15 years ago. But, you know, it was amazing to me how simple that was. And, you know, nobody complained, but they didn't want to spend $5 for that bag. And of course not. So, you know, there are simple things that can be done. We're just, you know, our political system is just too stupid at this point to find, discover, and use these simple tools.
We're this kind of follows on a number of things that have been said. Next Tuesday is a primary vote in New York State for the President of the United States. We're at a very critical moment. There's very clear choices. This stuckness of the political system. There's one candidate who's running on the Democratic side who is looking to really shift that in a major way. I'd really encourage people who are going to be voting to think about that and to think about being bold. What Jack has outlined is that we're in this crisis. It's going to require bold action. The same old is just not going to do it. So I'd really encourage people to think about that. And I'm assuming there's lots and lots of voters here in this crowd. So please think seriously about how you're going to, I guess we're filling in a thing to go in the thing. No more levers here in New York State. But thanks.
Not a question, but I would comment that every place in the world, in general, that's an overstatement. Many places in the world where women have strong political power are much better in terms of the environmental record. And, you know, there is also a really good argument for why we need a woman president now. And I don't see Hillary addressing these issues the way I see Bernie address them. So, you know, I think that hopefully if Hillary gets the nomination, then this political revolution will continue and you know, I think she, in her heart, she would want to do what's right. So, and if Bernie gets it, then, you know, it's still going to be a whole lot of work. So, yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with your analysis, but I think the other thing is true, too.
Good morning again. So I just wanted to put in a plug for my way of contributing to the environment, which is to use less water. Shorter showers, no water running. And when I do find water running, like people turning the water on when they go in the bathroom or I go in a restaurant and there's water just running in the sink, water has an infinite amount on this planet and we run out. And so I speak up and I say, why are you running water? And do you know that the amount of water you lost in that sink down that drain is more water than some people in a village have for an entire month? And just, okay, so I'm not done. So I say, challenge other people. If you figured out a way to reduce your footprint on the planet, then speak up and challenge your friends and challenge your family, because it was my son who called me out on it. So my question to you, though, Jack, mm-hmm. is you mentioned something about poverty and the environment, and there apparently is an effect on how much money you have and how much power you have and what happens to the planet and the environment. Could you say something how that has affected people locally or at least people in New York State? If you're poor, how does that happen? What happens to you when you're poor, to the environment around you? How does it affect you? Just maybe a couple of examples, or even one. Thanks.
Well, you know, there are so many ways that it affects people's ability. I mean, certainly education is a part. If you don't know, if you haven't learned, if there isn't a culture developed of conservation as you're talking, it's hard, you know, to do that. It's also true that, you know, if in fact that, and I think it is a fact, that every dollar is the equivalent of X amount of energy and material resources, poor people, regardless of, you know, whether they throw out trash wrong or something, you know, I have a lower footprint on the planet than rich people do, period. So, you know, what I think is a larger part of the issue is the structural poverty example in Syracuse, the structural poverty around the world, is a result of 300 years of colonialism, imperialism, that made it impossible. It makes it so difficult today to come to agreement, to work together. You know, the climate change is having a great effect in the Middle East and in North Africa. We don't talk, you know, we talk so much about terrorism, but there's almost no connection being made to what's happening in these places where people are getting more and more desperate. So we're going to have to deal with that. And we can't deal with it because of our history of racism and our history of the degradation of people in poverty. So, you know, to me, all those good things that we do, if we don't deal with those issues of justice, because it's the only way we're going to do this is together, globally. Now, you know, that may be a dream, and it was the dream, my 17-year-old dream, you know, with Lord Carrington and the British ambassador, you know, that somehow the world would come together, because we can't solve this problem in Syracuse. We can't solve it. We can make really good efforts. But the most important thing is coming together globally. And that can be done, but it can't be done without recognizing how historical forces have created conditions where there is a minority of people in the world who have a great deal of wealth and who have been responsible for the waste that has fed into the planetary crisis. And then there is a majority of the people of the world who have actually very low footprints. And until we grapple with that, all the other things aren't going to matter very much.
It isn't really a question as much as a statement. You all know that recently, over the past year or so, there's been big issues about importing trash. And that isn't going to happen. But one of the things that we do is keep track of how much trash is being burned. Now, yesterday it came up at our environmental meeting, and I asked the question, it seems like the trash burning is increasing, and what's the cause of that? And my answer was, the economy is getting better, people are more disposable. So as sad as that is, that, you know, locally, that is having an effect on our environment.
Well, and all of our goods are now so cheap because we don't add into the prices the environmental costs or the fact that, you know, people who are producing these goods don't have a living wage. And, you know, and so those things are very connected. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.